Hey, I'm Tracy Alexander, and welcome home. Home of Sapiens is a place we come to heal and to feel better about the world. It's a place to talk about real life in a way that gives us hope that we can move in the right direction. And this is episode one of season two. I am so excited to share this series with you after having been on an enormous journey since season one, calling off my engagement, healing from that breakup, completing my Vedic meditation initiator training, which was wildly challenging and deeply transformative in none of the ways I could have even tried to predict. And out of that metamorphosis, out of yet another releasing, resting, rising, and rebirthing, I bring you this new series. Season two is about everyday heroes, people who are showing up for life with a pen and a sword and carving their way through their own unique storyline, healing and heart leading and inspiring us as they go. As you may know, I'm a meditation teacher and an alignment mentor, and I left my job as a news anchor where I was pointing at the problem and the pain every day to teach the same tools that helped me through some of the hardest parts of my life. Because we are not here to suffer. We are here to learn, love, grow, and thrive. And that is what this podcast will help us do. This series is about identifying our power as individuals, how we can truthfully, honestly harness our experiences and become our very own heroes. These conversations remind us of our humanity, our ability to get through the daily challenges that life throws at us, and most importantly, it reminds us that we're not alone. These episodes are the matches that will spark the hero's fire inside of you. The hero that knows that the hard part is not where the story ends. This is where we rise. I'm a Vedic meditation teacher and the founder of the Alignment System, and I help you connect your body and your mind so that you can show up as your best, to live the life that you say that you want. If you want to learn Vedic meditation or take my body and mind stress management course or dive deeper into my one-on-one alignment mentoring system where you will experience a true rebirth around how you see yourself and how you show up for life in a sustainable, inspiring way, write to me on Instagram at TracyAlexander_ or visit TracyAlexander.co. So, let's start by really opening to what we're about to hear. Take a deep breath in and out. Move out of fear and into our hearts. This is Home of Sapiens, Everyday Heroes. Here we go. I feel so excited to dive into this episode and this series in general because it's been sitting in my heart for many months, but I haven't felt ready to pull the trigger until now. And you might notice that my voice has a different tone to it, deeper but softer, realer, truer. At least that's what it feels like to me, because these qualities are ones that I'm really honoring the process of fostering and honing as coming from a deeper, softer, realer, and truer place of unshackling from dogma, old stories and paradigms, from the rules of others, from the patterns of people pleasing and codependency, and liberating myself over and over and over again into alignment with the moment and to be able to meet the need of the time so that I can show up for you with our shared humanity by lifting each other up, cheerleading each other from a place of love and unity, and bridging gaps by seeing ourselves in the other. And when you work with me, you know that I'm all about honoring the human experience while allowing nature to guide us. And we do this by identifying what is sticky and what is creating friction and chaos, and how can we release ourselves from that and move into more flow toward more sophistication, which is what evolution is all about, and into that creation operator, and move into more trust and purpose and peace. And that doesn't always look how we think it might. So we learn how to ride the unknown, which everything is the unknown. And we learn how to revel in the discovery and the mystery and realize that actually we don't really want control as much as we might think that we do. And we don't really want the known. That's why Groundhog Day is a movie really of a nightmare that he's trying to escape. He doesn't want to keep living the same thing over and over again. We actually crave the adventure. Naturally, this is what we're encoded with. So we're all about harnessing our nature and being able to tap into our natural mechanics and the natural mechanics of the world in which we live, of which we only understand a fraction of. And that is what the hero's journey is all about. Making our way through the hurdles and overcoming obstacles and finding more freedom and rising again and inspiring ourselves and others along the way. So it follows so nicely after series one about resilience, because resilience is a huge piece in the hero's journey, as is inspiration, which is what this series is all about. The thing that is driving us forward, the thing that keeps us going. And today's episode, we'll be talking about one of the biggest barriers to us showing up as the version of ourselves that we dream of being. Stress. And I'll also be busting some misconceptions about meditation that cause many of us to say, I can't meditate, I'm not a good meditator, meditation's not for me, or that running is my meditation, art is my meditation, right? And oftentimes these can become barriers to you integrating one of the most profound tools for physical and mental health and nervous system mastery, which is the mastery of this whole experience, into your life. And that would be a real shame. So we'll learn about why you might be finding it hard to fall asleep and stay asleep. And you'll start to understand your body and mind better, why it is that you're feeling stuck, lethargic, full of worry, foggy, overthinking, why you're finding it hard to make decisions. Perhaps you're feeling super dependent on other people or food or substances. And there are reasons for all of it. So the good news is there's nothing wrong with you. You are not the reason. This is simple neurophysiology. And there is a solve to all of these experiences. So that's the good news. All right, so let's dive in and we'll start light. If we want to feel like our best selves, I would say that the rules for life are pretty simple. If we love ourselves, if we feel peaceful inside, if we don't feel bogged down by stress and the pressures of life, in those conditions, we show up in the world in helpful ways for ourselves and others. Conversely, when we feel stressed or afraid and disconnected, we show up in unhelpful ways for ourselves and others. If we haven't learned how to alchemize those experiences and to be able to use them for our growth and evolution. And it was these basic realities, understanding those two kind of containers or conditions, that led me to become a teacher of Vedic meditation and what informed the basis for my alignment system to stabilize the body and then update the mind. So I'll talk a little bit more a little bit later on as to why I work body and then mind. But I just want to bring us all up to speed in case this is the first episode that you've tuned into and you don't know much about me or my background, which if you want to know more about that and listen to all of the beautiful people I interviewed in series one, I'd highly recommend you go back and start listening to those episodes. But you can also just join us here. So the reason that I left my job as a news anchor and underwent one of the world's most rigorous trainings to become a Vedic meditation teacher is because when something changes your life so profoundly, it's only natural to want to share it with the world. I know so many people who, you know, experience that huge aha moment, and then the next thought is, oh, I have to share this with everybody. So I'd actually learnt Vedic meditation in my early 20s when I was looking for ways to feel better inside of myself. I'd been searching for years to find ways of finding just some peace and quiet from my mind. And this is often why people come to learn to meditate, is that we find ourselves to be such horrible company. We're looking actually for an escape. And what I teach people to do is how to be with and create an environment that we want to be with, because we'll never be able to escape ourselves. But at that point of my life, nothing I'd done prior to help me with anxiety and depression had really sustained itself until I learned this technique. And believe me, I felt at that time that I'd tried it all. And of course, I can't say that nothing worked. I believe that everything stands on the shoulders of what we've already done, and nothing is ever a waste. But the reason that this style of meditation created such enormous shifts for me is because it doesn't only work on the mind, it works on the body. It allowed my body to start telling a different story. Because up until then, my body held a lot of stories from times in the past that I'd been hurt or gotten stressed. We can use the word trauma, which is really too much too fast, and in this case for the nervous system. And so I'd become really good at feeling hurt or stressed. As we'll talk about later, what we practice, we get really good at. So my body had become really good at getting stressed and had almost become stuck there. And after a childhood trauma, my body had moved into a state of hypervigilance or hyper alertness. And so my system was always on guard, waiting for any potential danger. And all of these mechanics in our body, they're there for a reason. They're actually there to keep us alive, right? So this is my body doing exactly, you know, what it thought it needed to do, and it probably needed to do at the time. That's until it becomes unsustainable, and then we start to experience that it is no longer supportive. And living in this perpetual state of fight and flight sent my nervous system into a little meltdown, because the fight and flight response was dialed up high, presenting as chronic anxiety, as my body's way of keeping me alive. It also had to impose a down regulation response, which showed up as clinical depression. And if you know much about polyvagal theory, this has really revolutionized what we have now come to understand about these nervous system responses. So you can definitely look further into that. It's wildly fascinating and validating. And so this is often why stress-related anxiety also shows up alongside stress-related depression. Not that I knew any of this at the time. All I knew was that I had these anxious feelings and depressive thoughts. Now, what Vedic meditation did was it turned off the overfunctioning stress response. And this gave me access to a new way of thinking, so that I could actually have some space in my mind, have a clearer perspective. And now I was able to choose kinder and healthier thoughts. And we'll learn more about this later on, but when I talked about how what we practice, we get better at, when we get stressed, we train the part of the brain that is in charge of the stress response. when we come out of the stress response, we now move back into the part of our brain, our prefrontal cortex, which is in charge of focus, higher order thinking, problem solving, creativity, learning, and we're able to train that part of the brain and stabilize that part of the brain and feed that part of the brain. And we're able to then come out of stress, move into that part of our brain. And that's what really gave me my power back, essentially by helping my body come out of its habitual fear response so I could finally have some agency over my response to the world. And then I could show up as the person I wanted to be rather than one I almost had to be, living at the mercy of a dysregulated nervous system. And I use this technique in ways that I had never expected I would come to use it. It was not at all why I had come to use it. But I use this technique ultimately to help me succeed in my career as a news broadcaster. Because as you'll hear later on, this meditation practice changed the functioning of my brain to make it more resilient and able to remain clear, focused, and functional inside of high pressure situations. And it was actually while I was working in my job as a news anchor in the Middle East that I decided to become a meditation teacher. Because every day I would sit in the studio to host my nightly show called Perspectives. And I would talk about stories of war and terror and division and anger and hate and sickness. And I knew that this was just showing the limited perspective, or the full perspective rather, of what happens to us when we have a world of individuals living in fear. We only really have four choices when we're living in fear: fight, flee, freeze, or fawn. So these stories were just a manifestation of how we're feeling as individuals: afraid, angry, divided. I mean, it's obvious, right? If we can just look at our own behavior. I know how I behave when I'm feeling alone and disconnected and afraid. I become short-sighted and stunted. And these stories to me showed a disconnected world of people who feel alone and afraid. And I thought, what we actually need is some genuine perspective, a much broader, more empowered perspective. And at that point, I had been meditating for about 8 years, and I knew how much this technique had changed my life and had helped me move out of fear. And I knew there was another way. I knew that we don't have to feel so disempowered or blind to the truth. I knew that what we're all fighting for is to feel safe and loved. That's what we all want. It's what we're all entitled to. And I knew that the perspective that we need wasn't so hard to get, that it lies underneath the pile of fear that's clouding our hearts and limiting our choices. So as I sat there in my new studio, the studio that I worked in, I had this feeling that if we want a happier world, we need happier people. I know that sounds ideal and naive, but that felt really true to me and a mission that I want to be a part of. So I guess more realistically, we just need people who feel good inside and aren't stuck in fear, who have the ability to turn off the stress response and show up for life from a resource place. And the more of these people that we have, that's how we expand the sphere of influence. And that's how we can start to feel safer in our own world and start to exact change in the way that feels like we're cultivating more love. And that's kind of a narrative I want to be a part of. Even if I don't see that in my lifetime, and even if that's not to the point, that feels like a worthy mission to be involved in. So that's why I traded in one dream for another and left the news in favor of helping us get a deeper perspective, which is no longer looking to the outside world to make us feel good, but rather getting better at understanding and harnessing our inside world. So today, through this podcast, I hope to inspire you towards becoming the version of yourself that feels calm, confident, and connected to why you're here. Not pushing up against life and running yourself ragged, but rather to be able to show up as your best self, resourced and effective. To be able to embrace your entire human, not just the parts that you find easy to love, but also the parts that you might judge or think are hard to love. How do we include those and not run away from those, but run toward them to transmute them and alchemize them into our power? Because if we could all start to feel less stressed and less afraid, we'd all start to see stories in our lives and on the news that look much different than what we're seeing today. So let's start with what this technique is that has the power to remove stress from our physiology. What is this Vedic meditation? So Vedic is like saying in English, it comes from the Vedas, Vedic. And what are the Vedas? Veda means knowledge. And the Vedas are an ancient body of knowledge that comes from India, depending on who you ask, about 5,000 to 10,000 years ago, from where we get things like yoga, Ayurveda. So Veda we now know means knowledge, Ayur means life. So it's a life science, how to live in alignment with nature, and meditation. This style of meditation, a very pure and simple form of meditation. So Vedic meditation, as we call it, it goes by many different names, dates back to antiquity, and it has been passed down from teacher to student over thousands of years. So what does it actually involve? Well, let's first start with what it's not. So it does not fall into the category of meditation that's a concentrative style of meditation, nor is it a contemplative style of meditation. So it's not about concentrating, it's not about focusing, straining, or struggling against thoughts. It's not about trying to envision or imagine or evoke any kind of memory or state change. It's not about trying to imagine or envision or evoke any type of memory. It's not about sitting in uncomfortable positions for hours on end. It doesn't require you to believe in anything or shave your head and become a monk. And it's important to say this because when people hear the word meditation, oftentimes these ideas come to mind that are a muddle of a whole host of ideas that have been picked up out there in the marketplace, which is a great thing that meditation is so much in the collective consciousness at the moment, based on how much we so need it. The confusion, though, can be when there's come kind of a mushmash of things, when the word meditation is being used as a synonym, when really it's more of an umbrella heading for many different things. So when people say things like, I can't meditate, or I don't like meditation, it's like saying, I can't eat food, or I don't like food, right? So the question would be, which food? Because everything we eat has different effects on the body, and all different kinds of food needs to be prepared in different ways in order for us to get the benefits. The same goes with meditation. So which meditation can't you do, or which meditation don't you like? Because not all meditations are made the same. They're not all made for the same people and with the same desired effect. Also, you wouldn't go to a tennis coach if you wanted to learn how to swim. Right? Even if you went to the best tennis coach in all the land and your form of your serve was good enough to rival Rafael Nadal, if you jumped in the pool and then feverishly started swinging your forehand in the deep end, you know, I'm not sure how far you're going to get before it feels like you're drowning. You're just not going to be a very good swimmer, right? Because you're playing a very different sport. They're both sports, but they require very different techniques. They require very different instruction in order to gain the specific skills in order to get the desired outcome. And the same goes with meditation, you know, and no one likes to do anything they think they're failing at. So it's important to get the right instructions for that specific technique to get the desired results that this technique is designed to garner, because otherwise we will give up and we will miss out on gaining the marvelous benefits that meditation can have. So we know what it's not, but what is it? So Vedic meditation is a technique that is designed for what they call in India householders, meaning people like you and me who have jobs and families and busy lives and aren't looking to give those things up, but are rather wanting to be able to be involved with their lives more fully with greater ease and joy and capacity. So Vedic meditation in essence is a very simple, natural and effortless technique that anyone can learn. Anyone that can think a thought is able to learn and practice Vedic meditation. And we practice it for 20 minutes twice a day, sitting comfortably with our eyes closed. And we trigger a very natural process in the mind, which allows it to spontaneously and effortlessly de-excite and move within into these deeper, more restful and orderly states of consciousness. So when I say simple, what do I mean? So Vedic meditation, you can do anywhere you are. You can do it at your house, on a train, at the office, or even on a park bench, anywhere that you can sit comfortably and it's safe to close your eyes. And comfort is absolutely important. So in Vedic meditation, you sit in whatever way is comfortable for you. And if you get uncomfortable at any time, you can just adjust. And if you get itchy, you can scratch. It's very simple and easy and comfortable and natural. You know, life can be hard enough. So we don't want our meditation to be another hard thing to do. But what are we actually doing inside the mind that brings us into this deep state of rest and these more quiet, subtle states of awareness? We're practicing a technique of meditation that falls into a category called effortless transcendence. So what does effortless transcendence mean? Well, to transcend means to go beyond. And in this case, we're going beyond the thinking mind. And of course, we can't think our way beyond thought, can't think our way beyond thinking. And thinking requires effort, right? And so we can't try to get there, because trying involves a doing. And the minute that we're doing, we're now putting in effort. So it has to happen by itself. We're not looking to restrain the mind in any way. We're allowing it to naturally move towards where it wants to go, which is to these more blissful states of being. And we know it would like to make contact with those more blissful states of being, because when people come to learn to meditate, they have identified that this chaotic, noisy surface layer of their mind isn't as desirable as what they crave, which is this feeling of peace, right? And what we're doing with this technique is that we're taking advantage of the natural mechanics of the mind and the body and of the laws of nature. We're allowing it to do what it naturally wants to do. And so part of the nature that we exploit, I guess we could say, is the nature of the mind, that it is constantly searching for greater happiness. And you'll have experienced this, right? That everything that we do in life is in order to experience more happiness. And we have this kind of drive in us. Once I do that, then I'll be happy. Once I get that job, then I'll be happy. Once I leave that job, then I'll be happy. Once I meet that person and fall in love, then I'll be happy. Once that person leaves and I can get them out of my life, then I'll be happy. Once I eat that chocolate, once I save the rainforest, once I get my PhD, nothing's wrong with these things. This is just the way that the mind works, right? And we're going to use that natural mechanic of the mind to give it what it finds naturally charming in order for it to be naturally motivated toward the most supreme experience that it desires, right? So I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. How it works is if we think of the mind like the ocean. On the surface of the ocean, there's a lot of movement and activity. So if there's a storm outside, it directly impacts the surface layer of the ocean, creating chaos and disturbance. And the surface layer of the ocean is like the surface layer of the mind, where there's also a lot of activity. Right? And the mind, as you've probably experienced, is constantly moving. It's either trying to forecast the future or ruminate on the past. And an average person, they say, has about 60 to 80,000 thoughts a day. And up here on the surface layer of our mind is where we spend most of our time in all of this movement. But if we were to sink beneath the surface of the ocean, like a scuba diver, our experience of the ocean would start to change. It would start to become more still and quiet and orderly and vast and subtle. And the same can be said for the mind. So as we drift down into these more subtle states of awareness, the experience becomes more calm and quiet. And as I've just said, the mind would love to make contact with that part of our awareness, because in its bid for looking for greater happiness, it inherently knows that these states of consciousness would be more enjoyable than that chaos at the surface. But how do we make contact with these more quiet, restful states of our awareness? Because as a result of the intense activity at the surface of the mind and the content of our thoughts always having an outward invitation to them, right? An action at the end of them. We need to find a way to sink beneath the chaos in order to stop doing and settle and just be. So in Vedic meditation, we give the mind an instrument that will lure it inwards, and we give it something called a mantra, which we silently repeat in the mind, which works as kind of an anchor, kind of like a self-driving submarine that takes us down to the bottom of the ocean, from the gross state of the mind to our more subtle states of awareness. And on the first day of instruction, you will receive your own personal mantra or sound, which I will select for you. So a good time to then dive into what a mantra is and how it actually works inside of meditation, because you might have heard of the word mantra and think it to be something of an affirmation or a slogan. And in some cases, yeah, we could think about it like that, but the word mantra is actually a Sanskrit word that has found its way into the English vernacular, like yoga and guru and karma. But it's kind of, the meaning has become a little bit distorted in the way that we use it in the English language. Mantra comes from the Sanskrit words manas, which means mind, and tra, which means vehicle or instrument, tra, like the beginning of the English word transport. So mantra really just means mind vehicle. And as I said before, it's kind of like a self-driving submarine that takes you from the surface layer of the mind down into the subtle. And the reason that we say Vedic meditation is effortless is because the mantra is doing all of the work. It is taking you to the depths of the mind rather than you having to do anything to get there. Again, using natural mechanics, what the mind naturally wants to do when it is paired with the natural qualities of the mantra. So I'll explain this in a little bit more detail. So there are thousands of different mantra that all do different things, but the mantra that we use in Vedic meditation are called Bija mantras, Bija meaning seed. And they don't work on the level of meaning, they work on the level of sound. Now that's important because if we could associate a meaning or an experience or attach a memory to this sound, then it would evoke something in our mind and it would keep us stuck up in the surface. Like if your mantra was peace, it would conjure up all of these beautiful images of peace and happiness and loving kindness, which might be very wonderful to think about, but that is causing us to remain here in the thinking layer. So we want to use a sound that the mind can't associate a meaning with, and also that has a particular resonance to it, so that it will have a particular effect on the mind, allowing it to de-excite and almost pulling it down into our more subtle states of awareness. And the mantra that we use are mellifluous in nature, meaning sweet flowing, kind of like honey-like. So when we place the sound in the mind in a particular way, the mind, motivated by its innate nature to be searching for greater happiness, is naturally drawn to the sound. It's the most charming thing the mind can think. And then with each repetition, the sound lures the mind down into these more deeper and more subtle states of awareness. And as the mind is lured down into these more quiet states of awareness, it begins to experience bliss. And we also start to get this amazing chemistry brewing in the body of dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, this yummy cocktail that starts to infuse our cells and remind our physiology of this experience and normalize this experience and balance our body. All right, we've been talking for a little while, so let's just reset. Take a big breath in, breathing into your belly. Hold for a few moments and then just release, breathing out. Relax your shoulders. And let's dive in. All right, so we've been talking about the process of Vedic meditation, but what does this whole process really give us? Well, as the mind starts to de-excite and move into these more subtle states of awareness, the body moves into this deep state of rest, up to 5 times deeper than sleep, because the mind and the body are inextricably linked. So what happens in the mind impacts the body, and what happens in the body impacts the mind. So as the mind starts to make contact with these deeper states of awareness and it begins to have these experiences of bliss, the body moves into a deep state of rest. And when the body moves into a deep state of rest, it begins the very natural process of healing and repairing. And it begins to clean out the body of stress. So when we meditate, it's almost as if we are treating the body like a computer, right? We're taking its nervous system, the architecture, the hardwiring of our body, and we're shutting it down. So it's like we're closing down all the tabs on our computer and triggering a software update. And we're allowing the body to undergo a spring clean, and it begins to clear out all the junk so that once we turn the system back on, it can run more efficiently. I actually heard this wonderful analogy about Vedic meditation, that it is like a software update for our smartphone, where we plug it into a power source and the phone turns off, and it from the outside looks like not much is going on, but on the inside a whole cascade of processes are taking place in order to remove what is no longer relevant, in order for us to be able to use the phone far more efficiently with new, more relevant programming when we turn the phone back on. So that's why when we meditate, we're not spending our time or wasting our time, we're investing our time. We're filling up the tank. We're investing in the bank so that we can get back out onto the road and so that we can go out and spend. That's the idea. And so this idea of allowing the body to heal and move back into balance is the reason that we're doing the meditation. Believe it or not, it's not actually about the experience of meditation. It's not about that experience of transcendence. Because the whole reason we're meditating is not for how we feel inside of meditation. It's about how we feel outside of meditation, right? About how clear and agile and efficient and light and calm you feel during your life. That's the point. Because who cares if you have two 20-minute sessions that are absolutely blissful in your day, and then you go back out into your day and you are struggling to meet the demands and you're a complete emotional wreck. So one of the major reasons that we're doing this form of meditation is to give the body that deep rest that it needs so that it can heal and let go of stress. And when we give the body the chance to rest at such profound levels as we do in Vedic meditation, the body can do what it naturally wants to do, which is to restore balance and bring your body and mind back into equilibrium so that you can function without the burdens and deficits that stress is responsible for. So let's talk about stress. What is stress? We often think of stress as a situation, but stress is not the noisy neighbors at 3 a.m. the night before a big presentation. Stress is not the bumper-to-bumper traffic on your way to work. Stress is not having to write an exam or the screaming kids. Stress is actually the body's response to what the mind perceives as a threat. So it's when the body draws on its emergency reserves in order to meet a demand. And that means that a situation is not inherently stressful. It's our perception of a situation that causes the body to have a stress response. And what causes a stress response in one person doesn't necessarily trigger a stress response in another. So I like to say that stress is in the eye of the beholder. Because, for example, if I was sitting in this room here and a dog were to run into the room, right? I personally would be very excited by this prospect. Might be a bit peculiar, but yay, I really like dogs. So this would be a really welcome treat. But I know that if my cousin's little child, who has developed this little fear around dogs, if a dog were to run into the room, he would have a very different response to this exact same situation. Now, does that mean that a dog running into this room is a stressful situation? Well, not necessarily. Again, it depends who you ask. So the same goes, for example, with food. If I were to eat a banana, I would have a stress response in my body because I'm allergic to banana. That's something that my body can't tolerate. Whereas if you were to have a banana, you might find that wonderfully nourishing for your body. If I was asked to appear on live television right now, my body would have a very different response to that demand than perhaps somebody who has never had to do something like that before. And there's actually nothing wrong with a stress response, right? The stress response is an amazing and necessary survival mechanism that's been encoded into us by Mother Nature to help us in the case of genuine emergencies. And we've had this same survival mechanism operating in our physiology since we used to live out there in the more wild and predatory environments, millions of years ago, and we faced the very real threat of being eaten or attacked in the wild. And we are using this very same nervous system that we were using 200 to 500 million years ago today in our modern day world. And studies show that the body mounts the exact same stress response when running from a saber-toothed tiger as it does when somebody in the modern day world receives a parking ticket. And we do, of course, face very real threats in the modern day world. I mean, you know, it's not as common to be running from a knife-wielding assassin as it is to have a deadline at work. But regardless, in both those situations, the same stress response is triggered. And so let's now look at what actually happens inside the body when it mounts a stress response. So let's go back to, we're out there in the savannah and we are faced with a saber-toothed tiger. Our body needs to mobilize a lot of energy fast, in a fraction of a second, in order to generate superpowered strength, right? In order to respond to this threat. And the body is primed to respond in four major ways: to fight, to run, we might freeze, play dead, or fawn, which is to completely abandon yourself, where that idea of self-abandonment or giving yourself over comes from. And these are all survival mechanisms. And so what happens inside of the body in order to face this threat? The stress hormones, adrenaline and cortisol, shoot up in our body. And as a result of this burst of adrenaline, we get tunnel vision. And that narrows our perspective and it cuts off our higher order thinking, which is why when people are stressed or anxious, all they can do is focus on the problem. Our blood vessels constrict, our blood thickens, coagulates, which is why anxiety can lead to cardiac issues. You would begin to sweat, to perspire, and the sweat that we release when we're stressed has a very different chemical makeup to quote unquote ordinary sweat. You would find that it's quite high in acid, and too much acid never removed causes inflammation. Our immunity is suppressed, digestion is stopped, our reproductive organs are put on standby, because who cares if we're going to, you know, have sexy time later on and we're going to produce more children, or if we're going to get COVID or cancer, or if we're going to be able to digest this morning's breakfast. It's irrelevant in the long term if we're not going to make it through the next 3 minutes. And the body has limited resources, so it needs to pull upon everything that it can get right now in order to meet this demand. And if we make it through the demand, okay, then the body can go back into building those longer term projects. Now, this response is a very important response to this very clear life-threatening situation. That is exactly what we want to happen, because it allows us to respond to the threat. But the problem is that we, in our busy modern day lives, are switching on this response multiple times a day. And the saber-toothed tiger is really nothing more than a deadline at work, or a police siren, or the blue lights on our phone, or a controversial social media post, or a stack of bills in the mail, or I heard a fellow colleague use a wonderful example the other day of, when you're running late to an appointment and then a slow driving granny pulls out in front of you. Just can imagine, you know, the stress hormones kicking in while you're driving behind this slow driving granny trying to get to your appointment. So we're putting our bodies under major duress and preventing its natural healthy function unnecessarily in those situations, because a slow driving granny really isn't a threat to our life as much as we might perceive it to be so in that moment, which is why we are seeing all of these physical and mental health issues as a result of stress in our modern day world. And not only are we turning on the stress response quote unquote unnecessarily, but because we live very busy and imbalanced lives, we're taking on more stress than we're offsetting each day. So sleep, which is ultimately the mechanism by which we reset every day, is not serving the purpose for which we require in our modern day world, because our nervous systems have not evolved to meet the demand of, where I'm now releasing this podcast in 2023, right? The quality of our sleep, which is the body's natural way of removing stress, isn't actually what it should be. So as we continue to meet more demand than our nervous system has the capacity to respond to without the effective means by which to remove this stress, we just keep accumulating stress inside of our minds and our bodies. And so we always have a backlog of stress in our system. We are constantly living with a low-grade vibration of stress. And think about how we behave when we're stressed. When the saber-tooth tiger is charging at us, are we really able to think, oh, you know what, maybe if the saber-tooth tiger and I could just sit down and think of a creative solution to work our way through this, in a civil manner, so both myself and the tiger can walk away happy. Let's create a win-win here, right? That's absolutely not what's happening to us under the influence of stress, right? We have access to four options: fight, flee, freeze, or fawn. Those are our choices. It's a very, very limited response, right? So you can see why I am naming stress as one of the major factors preventing us from showing up as our best selves. Now, there's another piece to this, which is not only are we choosing to continue the lifestyle of having to meet more and more demand and allowing the dial to be turned up higher and higher in terms of this race against time to get to I'm not sure where. We also have this inner mechanic that dials up the pressure because us as humans with our highly intelligent brains, we have this double whammy when it comes to stress. So we have that stress that we perceive as meeting demand from the outside, but then we also have stress that is cultivated from the inside due to the fact that our human brain has this unique ability to forecast and imagine and remember. So our thoughts alone can actually trigger a stress response. So when we are sitting in the comfort of our own home and we're eating a delicious dinner and we're surrounded by our friends or our loved ones, we might get a little thought about something that could happen in the future, or about something that just happened, or that something that happened in the past, which we might call a trigger. And despite the infinite number of potential situations that could happen in the future, our mind will choose to focus on the doomsday scenario, right? We will just get a little thought that will cause us to worry about what might happen in our future. And as a result, we're triggering that very same stress response as if we were running from a tiger. Meantime, we're actually just sitting in the comfort of our own home with absolutely no threat in the environment. And that's speaking to something called the negativity bias, which no doubt you've already heard of and no doubt absolutely experienced. We're all wired this way, is that no matter how many good things might have happened in the day, we tend to focus on that one thing that went wrong. We could also say that we stress about that one thing that went wrong. And it makes sense that we focus on the problem when we're stressed, because that's a function of the stress response in and of itself, right? That tunnel vision I spoke about earlier, full focus on the problem, the inability to zoom out, access our higher order thinking, and see anything else. Adrenaline just simply won't let you. And this is that anxious loop when the stress response is going. The thoughts associated aren't the kindest, most helpful thoughts. They're oftentimes not actually based in reality. They're not based in the present moment. We don't have access to creative ways of linking ideas together. We just move straight to our most cruel, critical, lower grade thoughts. And so here we are playing horror movies to ourselves all day long, and further perpetuating that phenomenon called chronic background stress, whereby our set point, where we just naturally rest each day, is actually still a place of low-grade stress. Now, as I said before, stress itself isn't actually a problem if we are responding to an emergency. It's exactly what we want to happen. It's the frequency with which we're getting stressed and that we're taking on more stress than we offset each day. Because the impact of constant stress with no effective mechanisms to remove it or turn off the stress response for long enough for the body to heal and return to homeostasis is the reason so many people come to learn meditation. Why they're seeking ways of finding peace and quiet in their minds and bodies. Because their systems are just dialed up so high. And we're functioning in a modern world with the same nervous system response to stress, as I mentioned, that we had some 200 to 500 million years ago. But we're not actually behaving like our ancestors might have when we have a stress response, which is actually spending time doing the opposite and allowing ourselves to offset and discharge. When you watch an animal after a stress response, you'll see it does that shaking to offset the stress response. It also does those deep breaths, right? We don't allow the stress to move through our body. We don't cry or roar or dance, move, shake, process. We just hold and move forward and hold and move forward. Don't got time for this, or don't even want to feel this. Right? And we've also got the social conditioning that it's not appropriate to feel anything other than being strong and happy and positive and, completely unnatural. We have the full range of emotions because they're all there to be felt. We're meant to feel our feelings. And this is why we have such high levels of mental illness. In many cases, of course, not all cases, but in many cases, what is being dubbed as mental illness is a result of a dysregulated nervous system, a nervous system that's requiring some rehabilitation. And an interesting tidbit is that depression, for example, is often a result of our depressing the body's natural response to something. Instead of digesting it and metabolizing it and processing it and letting it through at the time of the event, we depress it, we push it down, and eventually we dysregulate our nervous system. That's just one function, of course. There is also the response, as I talked about earlier, to not being able to maintain a constant excitation of the nervous system. And so the body has to, in order to keep you alive, it has to downregulate. But a solve for depression is deep rest to allow the nervous system to recover, to allow what needs to find its way through to come through, to heal, to restore. And this is not only about disorders, this is just in order to offset that very common experience of feeling depressed. It doesn't always have to be a disorder. We can feel feelings of depression without it being a disorder. That's really important, especially for people recovering from a mental illness. They can feel a very ordinary feeling like sadness or fear or depression and think, oh no, I am having a relapse of a disorder that I used to live with. But in fact, it's just an ordinary emotion that all of us are primed to be able to feel and process very naturally. All right, that was a bit of a tangent. So back to the impact of our relationship with the world and the impact that ongoing stress is having on our overall health. It's why we see rising fertility issues in both men and women. It's why we see cardiovascular disease as one of the leading causes of death in the world. This is why we experience dis-ease, disease, the body's inability to find ease, to function naturally. Now, this would all be a terrible story, but this is not about the terrible story. This is about the hero's journey, the epic hero's tale, not the epic tragedy. So there is a turning point. There is a solve to this. And if you're listening to this podcast, you are able to access this solve. Anybody that can think a thought is able to practice the style of meditation that is designed to offset stress. So this is where meditation comes in. This is how I see meditation as this tool that is going to allow us to live our best lives. Because when we meditate using this technique, we turn the stress response off. We de-excite the nervous system and we bring the body into a deep state of rest. The body naturally moves into the process of rest and repair. And as a result, your body can naturally purify and heal and move back into a state of balance so that we can regain our ability to function in healthy, sustainable ways to life. And when we meditate, what we're doing is not only getting rid of stress from the day and from the past, but we're also training the brain to not get stressed unnecessarily in the future, to be able to discern whether this situation does in fact require a stress response. So we're building a more resilient, more reliable, more life-supporting nervous system. So how does this work in actuality? So I'm just going to outline just a few of many of the benefits of Vedic meditation to illustrate how it actually removes the burdens of stress, which brings us back into a state of optimal function. So we'll focus on three: resilience, sleep, and immunity. So we'll start with resilience. So when it comes to resilience, we want to develop the ability to keep going and not fall apart or burn out, right? It's about being able to stay calm under pressure rather than crumbling under the weight of it all. The ability to bounce back from adversity. And resilience is linked to high performance and overall success in life. So how does meditation help to cultivate resilience? So just like forming any habit, if we want to get better at something, we need to do it regularly and consistently over time. And the more we do it, the better we get at it. So just like what we've been doing up until this point, if we practice getting stressed, we'll get better at getting stressed. So conversely, if we practice staying calm, we'll get better at staying calm. So up until now, we have been practicing the stress response, and that means we've become really good at getting stressed, because every time we get stressed, we're growing a part of our brain called the amygdala, which is responsible for the stress response. Every time we get stressed, we're sending our resources to that part of the brain, and we have limited amount of resources. And at this point, our skull is only so big. So that means that we steal resources from elsewhere and we start to feed the amygdala, and it starts to get really strong. And therefore it's almost like digging a trench in that direction. So whenever there's an option, the water is going to go down that trench. It's just the easier path for it to go down. It's just like exercise. Every time we use the muscle, we strengthen it. And so if we strengthen certain muscles, if we meet challenge and all of the other muscles cannot bear the load, it will recruit the strongest muscle in order to be able to perform that task. So if we've strengthened our stress response, that's just the likely action that we're going to take. And as we strengthen our stress response, other parts of our brain are being starved of those resources. So our neocortex, which is responsible for our higher order thinking, our rationality, our creativity, our learning, this loses power while that stress response grows. But the good news, when we practice meditation, not only do we remove stress from the body, but we start to give the brain training in the opposite direction. So just like how we form any habit, if we do something once, it's like laying down a little piece of string. And if we do it again, we lay down another piece of string on top of that string. And if we do it again, we lay down another piece of string on top of that string, and then we end up developing a very sturdy rope. This is how we form our neural pathways. But every time we meditate, we remove a string from the direction that we've been growing it in, and we start to lay down new strings, new pathways. And every time we allow our nervous system to consistently de-excite and move into calm and bliss and satiety, we start to train our brain in that direction. So that outside of meditation, in the face of challenges or high demand, the mind and the body is now conditioned toward that state. Because in Vedic meditation, we don't move into a state of sleep. We've moved into the fourth verifiable state of consciousness called transcendence. And as we stabilize that state, we allow ourselves to remain in that expanded state of awareness, meaning we've grown our consciousness and our ability to hold more in one awareness when our eyes are open. So that's why meditators find that they become less reactive to the world. They become more resilient. Not only because they've trained their brain to be able to hold more, but because they actually have removed stress from their nervous system. So there is more space in the cup. They're not living at the end of their fuse. Now, this was actually the first benefit I noticed from my meditation practice. I noticed I was less reactive. It's not at all why I came to learn to meditate, but I absolutely got that benefit straight out of the gate, and I was able to remain calm during moments of high demand. The first sign of that was just a few months after meditating. I tell the story in my meditation course about what I noticed while I was working at Channel 9, and I'd wanted to become a live reporter in the field. I was just a general reporter at the time. I won't go into that whole piece now, but let's just say this training of my brain continued to serve me professionally. Working as a live correspondent, I ended up working for the Today Show and then went on to working in international news as the anchor of my own nightly primetime show, which required oftentimes hours long coverage of breaking news. And so I had conditioned my brain to be able to perform that task. I attribute that to my meditation practice. Another benefit that we gain from practicing Vedic meditation consistently is that our sleep improves. So a lot of people suffering from insomnia come to learn Vedic meditation. A lot of people come because they want to reduce stress in their lives, but we know that one of the most common sources of stress is fatigue. Right? It's this vicious cycle. Because we're stressed, it's hard for us to sleep. And because we can't sleep, our bodies are stressed. And then we develop this very dysfunctional relationship with sleep, which presents as two common experiences. The first is the inability to fall asleep, and the second is the inability to stay asleep. So the reason that we aren't sleeping is because we are living on our emergency reserves of energy. And as a result of our busy modern day lives, our phones and computers being on all the time, the invention of the light globe, which means that we stay up later than nature intends, our bodies are jacked up on adrenaline and cortisol. And whenever we get that sensation to take a nap, instead we smash some caffeine, which blocks the adenosine receptors, which are telling us that we're really tired and we ought to take a nap. The caffeine blocks that, so we think that we're not tired. And then in order to keep going and meeting the demand, the body needs to mount a stress response, pulling on its emergency reserves. And then we just build up this nervous energy. So then what happens when our head hits the pillow? So the minute that the body moves towards a state of de-excitation, it begins the process of offsetting stress. And one of the signs of stress release is thoughts. It's part of the stress digestion process. And this happens anytime we de-excite, either when we sleep or when we meditate. So if we meditate, by the time we go to sleep, the body has already done that process of waste removal twice. So that when our head hits the pillow, we don't experience those incessant thoughts with invitations toward action at the end of them, the things that tell us, oh, what we have to do or we could have done better, the way that we review the day, never tends to be in the direction of praising ourselves or celebrating what we got done through the day. It tends to be beating ourselves up or stressing about what has to happen the next day. So instead of that happening when we go to sleep, we've already had the opportunity to remove the stress, remove the cortisol, have that experience of offsetting the stress before it's time to go to sleep, so that now that our head hits the pillow, we can easily drift off to snooze land. And when it comes to staying asleep, I actually created a little video about this on my Instagram, which got a huge response of people saying, yeah, that's definitely happened to me. When you have fallen asleep and then you get that annoying 2:30 a.m. wake up, when your mind just springs awake and now you can't fall back to sleep. So the reason that happens is because the body naturally releases cortisol at around that time to begin the slow and gradual process of waking you up to begin the day. But if your body is already jacked with that stress hormone cortisol from a buildup of stress in your life, that little natural release will tip you over the edge into a full-blown stress response. And that's why we wake up with our mind racing like the world is going to end. However, if we meditate, by the time we go to sleep, we have already purged that extra cortisol from the body so that we can have that natural wake up in the morning. Now, the last benefit that I wanted to talk about, because we've been talking for a long time, is immunity. We talked before about what happens during the stress response and how the body pulls on the emergency reserves and it stops the normal functioning of the long-term projects in our body. So this is a wonderful analogy that my teacher shared with me. Let's imagine that the body is like a city. And all of a sudden, there is a huge fire in the center of town, a big emergency. So what's going to happen is that all of the emergency vehicles are dispatched and rushed to the scene. And in order to get them there efficiently, all the other roads need to be blocked. So the buses are stopped, the food trucks are stopped, the construction stops, the street cleaners are halted, all to make way for the emergency vehicles. And that's the right thing to happen. It's exactly what we want to happen. But if that state of affairs were to continue for months on end, the whole city would eventually break down and it would stop functioning and it would no longer be a habitable city. And the same can be said for our bodies. In fight and flight, the body redirects resources that are dedicated to the ongoing functioning of the immune system. Why? As I mentioned before, because preventing cancer or a cold is less relevant in the short term if we're not even going to make it past today. So again, this makes sense in the case of a genuine emergency. But if we're getting stressed in non-life-threatening situations, we're suppressing the immune system unnecessarily. And this goes with our reproductive system and our digestive system. You might notice that your digestive system is the first thing that gets kicked around during a stress response. You may get that feeling of needing to rush to the bathroom, right? This is in the body's bid to offset any extra weight, to be lighter for the fight or to run away. And the other issue is that the stress response becomes overactive in localized parts of the body. And this causes something called inflammation. And inflammation is the root cause of a huge number of chronic conditions. So what meditation does is that it simply restores our natural level of immunity by turning off the stress response and allowing the body to purify and heal and return to balance. So a huge decision for me was to make this a non-negotiable part of my life, not only because at the time I absolutely was desperate and I no longer wanted to live and experience the way that I was experiencing the world with so much angst and struggle, but it gave me so much freedom That not only did I continue to integrate this into my life, but of course I found it compelling enough to change my entire career to teach this to other people, because this technique is what gave me my mind and my body back in ways that I just didn't have access to while I was living with a deeply stressed out nervous system. And then, of course, over time, my life started to open up in other ways that I could not have expected. The way I see it is that it is just something that is wise to do in order to maintain our physical and mental health, right? It's like brushing our teeth. It is like showering. We know what happens in the short term if we don't brush our teeth, and we also know what happens in the long term. People don't want to be around us in the short term, and in the long term, we end up, with deeper issues like cavities, etc. And if we don't shower in the short term, we know what that's like. Again, not the nicest person to be around. And in the long term, we know we end up with skin sores, etc., and things that we need to treat on a deeper level. The same goes with meditation, right? It's actually not a luxury. It is something that is required in this day and age. It's just the natural washcloth for the mind, the same way that brushing our teeth is something that we do without even thinking, whether we are in the mood for it or not, whether we feel like it or not. We just know what will happen if we don't. And of course, we've run the experiment, right? We've seen what happens when we don't have an effective stress management and mind management regime. And just one final remark before, of course, we need to wrap up. While people might say, running is my meditation or art is my meditation, it's not quite true because they all do very different things for the mind and the body. You may feel peace momentarily. You may have the rush of endorphins and tap into a flow state in different ways while doing all of these things. However, very different neural pathways are being activated and strengthened in the nervous system, and very different benefits are being experienced as a result of de-exciting the nervous system and spending consistent periods of time in this fourth verifiable state of consciousness. And very different impact are having on the body and the mind by allowing the mind to stabilize in this state of transcendence intentionally and specifically every day. So de-exciting versus exciting the nervous system, these have very different impacts on the nervous system and in the combating of deep, deep stresses that are being held in the body. So exercise is different to creative expression, is different to meditation. They don't cancel each other out. They don't replace one another. So it's kind of like saying exercise or music is my food. They might all give you fuel. They might make you feel satiated and content, but they ain't the same thing. So that's just one little misconception that I really wanted to clear up. Now, of course, there are many other benefits that we gain from a consistent meditation practice. And no matter what reason you come to learn meditation, you are set to get all of those benefits because that's just what happens as we train those neural pathways. But this is also the reason that I work body and then mind. As we've talked about, the body is what governs the stress response, and the body moves into stress before the mind can even decide what it's going to do. For example, you may get a fright, and then a few seconds later, you realize, oh, I didn't need to have that stress response. But the body responds first. And so once we bring the body out of stress, then we can actually start to change the beliefs in our minds and access our prefrontal cortex and actually start to make sense of the world in more empowered ways. If the body is stuck in stress, we don't have access to our higher order thinking. So we actually need to de-excite the body so that it is primed for change. We can then manage our emotional world with greater mastery. We can show up for the things that we love with more enthusiasm, and we can bounce back more swiftly when life gets hard. So, meditation or nervous system regulation, as a caveat, will never take away the experience of being human. We will still respond like a human is designed to respond, but it will make the experience easier than it could be without it. So I'll leave that there for now. It feels really good to have been able to share this in such depth with you. Of course, this all comes from my heart. I often think about how wild it is that a meditation technique can arouse such passion inside of me, and that the journey it's taken me on has been compelling enough for me to change the entire trajectory of my life to be able to teach this to you. Life is certainly a chapter book with glorious twists and turns, and I'm here for all of it. So if you have any questions or want to find out about how to learn Vedic meditation, you can head to my website. It's tracyalexander.co. Now, as it was last season, episode one was an episode with just me alone, and it's the same way here in season two. But as of next week, we'll begin the conversations with a string of incredible guests who have stories that will make you feel deeply seen and like you are normal. We all think we're our unique version of crazy, but the likelihood is that we're all the same kind of crazy. And these stories will allow you to feel inspired to tap into what is possible for you. That is what I hope, that we can all look at each other and see a reflection of what we want ourselves and what we can have with the right mindset and the community to support that. If you liked this episode, I would so appreciate your support. Please rate it and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It's possible to do that. It really helps, and it means a lot to me to hear from you so that I know I'm not talking into an echo chamber, and to really know if these episodes are impacting you so I know what you like and what I can deliver more of. If you didn't like this, you've made it very, very far, so I appreciate you sticking around this long. That is it. I will see you next week. I'm sending you all of my love. Have an incredible, incredible week.